Got it, Joey. Thank you. Attaboy. I can tell you that. Hey, hey, what, hey. I like this. Teamwork. That's great. Thank you. So tonight, we're going to move into kind of the next main portion of our topics for RCAA, which focuses on the moral life, living a good moral life in accordance with God's commandments and with the teachings of the church, which has been given to us by Christ and has been guided for the last 2,000 years by the Holy Spirit. So we have a very special guest presenter that's going to be with us tonight. We have the privilege of having Dr. Gideon Barr, who just recently received his doctorate in theology from Ave Maria University in Florida. Prior to that, and doing a number of other studies, he used to be a seminarian for our diocese and discerned that for a time prior to discerning out, and then God led him down to Ave Maria, and he eventually got his doctorate. And is down there. He also met his wife, Anne, who is with us this evening. Anne, you can wait. Okay. Beautiful wife, Anne, is with us, and they have a 1.5-year-old son, roughly. Okay. 1.5-year-old son, Cyril Joseph. So they have started their wonderful little family already. But Dr. Barr is the, I guess we could say, the founder of the Aquinas Institute that is located at the St. John Henry Newman Center up at CMOS campus in Cape Girardeau. And is currently he's been teaching a couple of classes, and the hope for the Aquinas Institute is also to be a continuing education branch for many aspects of our diocese, including teachers, catechists, and even priests as well. So we're very excited about the future of the Aquinas Institute, and we're very grateful to Dr. Barr for his efforts and for his love that he has for the church. I've been a good friend. He's of Dr. Barr for several years, and so it's a privilege to have him come down and to share his wisdom with us as he speaks about the foundations of Catholic morality. So without further ado, I'd like to introduce Dr. Barr, and let's give him a warm welcome.
Thank you, Father. Thank you all for having me here. I've known Father for a long time, and he has a kind of talent for delivering a memorable line. And when I was, is this on? Okay, this. When I was thinking about going to the seminary, I remember we met one day for coffee, and sort of coffee and a bagel or something one morning. And I told him, yeah, I think I'm going to go to seminary. And he said, Gideon, be careful. The girls will come out of the woodwork. And I always remember that. It's very funny. There's no lesson there. It's just a good one. So I'm very pleased to be with you and to be speaking about the foundations of morality. So the catechism, if you know, is in four major parts. The first part deals with God and divine revelation and like salvation history. The second part with the creed and the articles of faith, some of the basic truths of our faith. The fourth part is about prayer and the interior life or the spiritual life. But the third part is about morality and life in Christ, what living as a Christian means and looks like. And so it's no small part of our faith and of what the church proposes to us for our belief and our practice as Catholic Christians. And so it's an important part of RCIA as some of you prepare to receive sacraments and to be united to the church more fully. So I'm very pleased to speak to you about this. And moral theology is sort of a area that I focus in, but I have to confess and sort of warn you that the notes that I'm going to be using tonight and the slides are not my own, and so if I kind of stumble through them, please bear with me. I have my own notes that I use for my classes and things, but they're in a different order, and so I might be a little, I might kind of lose myself and have to look and check the notes, so just bear with me. So let's begin our discussion. So, Pope John Paul II wrote a very famous encyclical letter, a document on moral theology or on the church's moral teaching. And he begins that document with this reflection from the Gospel of Matthew, in which the rich young man comes to Jesus. And he says, "Teacher, what good must I do to have eternal life?" And St. John Paul II undertakes a kind of interpretation of this passage to help all Christians, but and moral theologians, and anyone thinking about morality, to focus on the Lord, to focus on Jesus, as the source of our moral wisdom, and in some ways, the end or the goal of our moral striving. So it's not only that Jesus teaches us about morality, but he also is the sort of the measure or the standard and the goal of our moral lives is conformity with Jesus. And so this interaction between Jesus and the rich young man kind of clues us into that the moral life isn't an abstract set of rules primarily, or even a list of forbidden actions, but rather it's this encounter with Jesus and a learning from him and a becoming like him. And so that encounter with Jesus is ultimately also a response to the desires of the human heart. So why does the rich young man go to Jesus? Well, because he assumes that Jesus knows something he doesn't know, but also because he recognizes in Jesus an answer to a question that he himself has. And so what Jesus proposes to us is a life of happiness, of fulfillment, and of perfection. And so morality is going to consider human actions, what human beings do, the things that we do and do not do, but all of those things in relation to a goal, and that goal is happiness. And so morality or ethics is going to be considering human actions, what human beings do, and whether those actions tend toward or bring about real happiness, or whether they do not, okay? And so, and the happiness that Jesus proposes to this young man is not a mere earthly and mundane happiness, but it's a supernatural and eternal happiness. And what the church proposes for our belief is a belief in a real kind of union with God in the beatific vision in heaven. Okay, so the happiness that the church proposes and that she teaches about and guides us in and shapes our morality is all in relation to the eternal happiness of heaven. Okay, so the church's moral teaching is all going to be about how to get to heaven, right, and how to avoid hell. That's what the church's moral teaching is about. And it's going to treat a lot of different kinds of questions all in relation to that final happiness or complete fulfillment of heaven. So, the church proposes to human beings and to Catholics for belief certain moral truths or moral guidelines, moral rules. And it's important that she proposes them to us, right? So, I might lecture college students about ethics or about morality, but I don't go out into the woods and lecture the squirrels about it, right? And I don't go to the lake and lecture the fish about it either. Well, why not? Well, because the fish and the squirrels aren't free, right? They don't have possession of themselves in such a way to guide and direct themselves and to choose freely about what it is they do and do not do, right? They're guided by their instincts. Human beings, in addition to instincts, also have freedom, though. And it's our reason, our rationality, our rational soul that allows us to have this perfection of freedom, the ability to say yes or no to certain things. And this freedom, this power to determine ourselves to act in one way and not another, ultimately makes us responsible. Okay? It makes us responsible. And so we have such a kind of freedom that, and we're able to freely direct ourselves, that it matters and it reflects and sort of redounds upon our own character what we do with that freedom. Okay? our freedom and the way we use it changes us. Okay? It makes us to be good or evil, virtuous or vicious. Okay? That's what responsibility means. Okay. So this is sort of diving deep into the nitty-gritty, and I'm going to do my best here to help explain this, but when we're talking about human actions, what human beings do, okay, and we're trying to evaluate them morally, both philosophy and theology has come up with an understanding of a particular human action. So I steal Father Kelly's car, right, or I bring flowers to my mother, or I go visit a sick person in the hospital. These are all discrete human actions, okay? Some of them are bad, some of them are good. But all of them have three parts. And the three parts are their object, their intention, that is what they're trying to achieve, and their circumstances, that is the kind of the who, what, how, when, where, and why, that kind of thing, right? And for any particular moral action to be good, all three of these things have to be good. They have to be kind of integrally good or holistically good. If one of them is bad, it can spoil and does indeed spoil the whole action. Okay? So we want to understand what each of these things is. And the first and hardest one to understand is the object. Okay? And there's a lot of... this can be a difficult thing to understand, but I'll do my best. So... the object is the thing or the action toward which our wills, that is our power of choosing, directs itself. It's what a person chooses. It's the means someone undertakes. Okay? And when I say it's the means someone undertakes, it's not just like the external thing that is done, but it's also the reason that I'm doing it. And I'll give an example. It's a funny one. Ethics can be funny. Imagine, if you will, two men in two different scenarios. One man is on the sidewalk, and he pushes an old lady into the way of an oncoming bus, okay? Another man in a different scenario pushes an old lady out of the way of an oncoming bus, right? Materially, it's the same act, right? But it would be morally sort of absurd to describe both of them as just guys who like to push old ladies around. Okay? No, right? The reason why they did it also enters into what they did. Right? It'd be sort of deficient to just describe it as pushing old ladies around. Rather, someone was trying to get rid of somebody and someone was trying to save somebody. And that matters. That's what the object is. It's what is done in relation to why it is done. The intention is the why, right? It's the reason someone performs an action. It's the end or goal they're trying to achieve. People can have many intentions. Sometimes intentions are layered kind of one upon another. I do this for the sake of that, for the sake of a third thing. But the important thing to note is that a good intention cannot justify a bad action. If a good intention could justify a bad action, we could constantly just re-describe what we're doing with our intention, and it would seem like it was a good thing. Okay? Imagine, if you will, kind of like Roman times, or let's say like the Lion King movie, where the evil Uncle Scar, right? Let's say the king dies, the little child or the son inherits the throne, and the evil uncle, he kills the son, right? Why does he do it? Well, because he wants to consolidate power for himself. Well, what he can't say when he's killing the son is, I'm just preventing dynastic civil war, right? Because if this little child inherits, then factions will break out and the peace of the empire will be destroyed, right? He can't just say, he can't just describe his action with his intention. That's not sufficient, right? Rather, what he is doing, the object also matters. Okay, so this is a kind of perennial error that St. John Paul II actually condemns in Veritatis Splendor. It's called intentionalism. That is, any good intention can justify any bad action. In addition to the object and the intention of our actions, there's also the circumstances. these are secondary kind of accidents, you know. The lights could be on when I do it, they could be off, it could be raining, right? It could be midday, it could be nighttime, right? I could be in Oran, I could be in Cape. These are all accidents of a particular action. The accidents or the circumstances of an action can sort of increase or decrease an act, right? The example given here is the amount of money a person gives, right? The numerical amount, right, is sort of accidental to the act of giving. But if someone gives to the point of sacrifice, that could be more meritorious than someone who doesn't. An important thing to note with circumstances is that sometimes circumstances can be more than circumstances. And the classic example here is, let's say you borrow a rifle from your neighbor to go shooting or to go hunting, and then you're done with it, but you still have the rifle, and your neighbor is, you were going to return it, but kind of time went by, and you happen to still have it. And your neighbor gets into one of his classic drunken rages, right? And he's fighting with his brother out in the front yard, right? And he comes and he bangs on your door and he says, "Give me that rifle that I lent you." Right? Well, normally, returning borrowed property is a good thing to do, right? But the circumstances in which this happens, right, when your neighbor's in a drunken rage, makes what you're doing, returning a borrowed rifle, really a little bit more than returning a borrowed rifle, okay? You're equipping a man with a gun, which is a different thing. Okay, so in order for an action to be good, the object, the intention, and the circumstances all have to be good. Any one of these going wrong can make an act evil. So if the circumstances are wrong, it can be sort of more than a circumstance and they can make the act bad. If the object is wrong, no good intention can justify it. And if the intention is wrong, a bad intention, even with a good object, can make the act wrong. Okay, so if the classic example here is like giving alms, right, or making a donation, right? If I make the donation to only to sort of increase my pride or so that other people see, what is ultimately a good object, that is giving to charity, is ultimately bad for me. It makes me bad because I'm doing it for a bad reason, right? So all three of these have to be good: the object, the intention, and the circumstances. And it's this kind of analysis that grounds the church's teaching about what this calls absolute moral norms, or at other times are called intrinsically evil actions. Sometimes they're called per se evil, things that are evil in themselves. And these are objects, things that are done, which no intention, however good, can ever justify. And so when the church teaches that certain things are forbidden absolutely, that there are no circumstances or intentions that can make these things good, she's saying that there are certain objects such that choosing them with your will, that is, using your power of choice to elect, to affect those actions, right, can never be good under any circumstances or regardless of any intentions. Okay, so a good intention doesn't justify an evil object. And the church helps us to identify those evil things, those intrinsically evil actions that can't be part of a good life oriented toward God and to heaven. However, as many of you know, or as all of you know, we're not simply creatures with intellects and wills, right? We're not angelic, right? We also have bodies, and along with our bodies come our passions or our feelings and our emotions. And our primary kind of motor, as it were, of choice, right, of freedom and of desiring and choosing, is our will, right? But our passions are kind of like sub-motors, right? They have their kind of movement of their own, okay? And sometimes they're right, but often they're wrong, and they need to be guided and directed by our mind and our intellect and our will. And so, in and of themselves, our passions, our emotions aren't good or evil, but insofar as they help us to make good choices with our intellect and our will, they are good. Insofar as they make it difficult or present an obstacle to us making good choices with our intellect and our will, they can be bad. and they can make a person vicious. Okay, so that's a little sort of primer on human action. In a way, though, all of us, in some ways, are also sort of witnesses and judges of our actions, sort of to ourselves, right? It's common to say a person is being hard on themselves, you know, or something like that. And this is what the church refers to as our conscience, okay, our conscience. So the definition given here is that our conscience is a judgment of reason, which enables a person to recognize the quality, the moral quality, or the ethical quality of their actions. So it's a judgment of our conscience is a judgment of our reason, our mind, judging our action, a particular action that we undertake, in search of ethical truth. So our conscience is always trying to figure out, is this a good act or a bad act? And it's really, our conscience is kind of a sacred thing, right? It's not, because we are sort of aware of ourselves and present to ourselves, and we have that responsibility for our actions, the church has always recognized in conscience a very sacred thing. And at the Second Vatican Council, it calls it man's most secret core, his sanctuary. And it's there alone with God that God's voice echoes in man's depth. And so the church has always recognized in conscience not just our own voices, but in some way the voice or the guidance or the kind of memory of God and of God's law and of God's instruction about the moral life. And so it's our conscience, because it's an aspect of our reason, of our intellect, our conscience can be sort of more finely tuned or less finely tuned, more sensitive and capable of judging about whether something is good or evil, or sort of less sensitive and less capable of judging accurately whether our actions are good or evil. And because of that ability to kind of grow in sensitivity and accuracy, we can form our conscience. Well, how do we do that? Well, because our conscience is a judgment of our mind, right? If a person comes to know with greater certainty and clarity moral truth, their conscience is helped by this, right? And their conscience can become more formed, more sensitive, and more accurate about what is truly good in our actions. And so ways in which we can inform our conscience range from learning about very general and widely applicable ethical truths, like the Ten Commandments, for example, all the way down to particular things. So if someone's a doctor, right, which is a profession that's sort of very much subject to ethics, right? Learning more about the particular medical aspects of like a procedure or of a medication or something can also inform their conscience, right? Because what their conscience needs ultimately to make a good judgment is truth. It needs moral truth. And so whether that's very general moral truth or particular moral truth, all of it helps, right? And so through all of this, but especially through divine moral truth, the Ten Commandments, the Church's teaching, the example of the saints, and through various spiritual practices, a person can form and make more sensitive and more accurate their own conscience. So these are actually some pretty helpful rules about conscience. So a good rule is that first that one can never do evil, so that good may result from it, which is just another way of restating what we've talked about the object. The golden rule. It's also important that your conscience can be as accurate as anyone else's, but if you don't heed it, right, if you don't do what your conscience says, or you don't refrain from what your conscience says to refrain from, you're actually hurting your conscience. Right? So if you know what is true and you do what is true and good, but you do what is false and evil, you will eventually know less and less about what is true and good. So people who do stupid and wicked things become stupider and wickeder than they ever intended. Okay? So always listen to your conscience. If you're uncertain, if you have a doubtful conscience, it's probably best to refrain from acting. And if your conscience is not well instructed, you have a responsibility to form it, right? And if you come to find out that you thought what you did was right, but it's really wrong, you have a responsibility to change your mind. This is a little bit of a finer point about what's called an erroneous conscience. So when our consciences are wrong, which can be the case. So what our conscience is not is this sort of like infallible guide. Well, my conscience said it was right, so it was definitely the right thing to do. No, sometimes when we are very certain about what we have done or what we want to do, right? Human beings, our level of certainty is not an accurate gauge of something's level of truth, okay? Sometimes people can be very certain about things that they're very wrong about, okay? Mm-hmm. And so this can also be the case with our conscience and with respect to moral action. We can kind of have a self-certainty that, yeah, this is the right thing. But in all actuality, it's the wrong thing, okay? And there can be kind of two states of that kind of ignorance, right, when you don't know the truth. One is called invincible, and it just refers to the state that the person is not responsible, as it were, for arriving in that state of ignorance. As compared with vincible ignorance, in which the person sort of is responsible for arriving and being in that state of ignorance. So as always, being proactive in seeking out moral truth is the better course, right, for avoiding these situations of ignorance and an erroneous conscience. Okay, so we're going to make one more transition here, and then we'll close this section. And tonight, is it all right maybe if we take a couple of like 5-minute breaks? Is that fine? Okay. Yeah, that's what we'll do. I've got the microphone. All right, so... So to finish this section, I want to talk about virtue, okay? So what is a virtue? Well, when human beings act, when we make choices and we do things, we're actually changed by our choices. All right? Our choices sort of rebound and affect us. And typically this is referred to as our character, right? So a person has good character or they have bad character. Well, how do you get a character? Well, by acting, right? A person who's done a bunch of evil deeds forms an evil character. A person who's done a bunch of good deeds forms a good character, okay? And the sort of the motors or the centers of activity for a good character, right, are called virtues, right? So good character, another way to say that is that someone is virtuous, right? Is they possess all of the virtues. And what is a virtue? Well, it's a certain kind of habit, which is just a disposition, right? Or a tendency. So virtue is a habitual perfection of the intellect and will to govern our actions, to order our passions, and to guide our conduct. And typically, virtues are acquired by repeated and consistent practice. So if any of you were ever or currently are athletes, you know that how does someone get better at something? Well, through practice, right? How does someone get better at a sport? Well, through practice. And virtues are really no different. They're increased by progressively more intensive and extensive operation. That's how virtues grow in us, when we do things more intensively or extensively. So a joke I like to make here, you know, when I'm talking about virtue, is that not just any kind of action will do to actually make a virtue grow or to stimulate growth in a virtue. So like NBA players, when they go to practice basketball, they don't play horse, right? They don't just sort of walk in the gym and like, put that there, pass the ball. They don't just sort of play lackadaisically, but rather they push themselves. They play harder in practice maybe than they do in games, right? They shoot more shots, right? If if a third grader can get better at basketball by shooting 50 free throws, right, an NBA player gets better at free throws by shooting 1,000, right? It's got to be more intensive or extensive. And in human beings, in our moral lives, when our actions, that is the judgments of our mind, the choices of our will, the movements of our passions, when these, through our operation, become more perfect in inclining us and giving us a tendency to do what is good and right and true, right? We call those virtues. And there's a great little beautiful quote here from St. Gregory of Nyssa where he says, the goal of the virtuous life is to become like God. And so if by sin we lost the perfection of God's image in us, it's by the life of virtue and grace that that is restored. And so I said typically virtues are increased by intensive and extensive operation. But really properly this refers to natural virtues, the kind of virtues that we can build in our normal everyday life. But the kind of virtues that we can build in our normal and everyday life are not sufficient to get us to heaven. Okay? Right? They're not sufficient to get us to heaven. What is needed to get us to heaven is grace. Okay? We need divine grace to get us to heaven. And the grace that God gives us isn't simply generic, but God gives us specific gifts. So when a person is in a state of grace, they have specific endowments, specific gifts of grace. And some of these are supernatural virtues. Supernatural virtues. And these aren't achieved simply by going out in the world and acting, but they're achieved by the reception of grace. And so they're infused into us. Right? And it's God who brings them about and brings about their increase in us. And so the Christian moral life isn't simply a life of natural integrity. Right? It's not just being honest and doing the right thing and that kind of virtue that a person can develop in their normal human life. But it's a call above and beyond all of that. It's a call to Christ-like virtue. Christ just wasn't a good guy who kind of did the right thing, right? But rather, he was the Word made flesh, right? He was the Son of God. And there's a moral perfection and kind of plenitude or fullness of love and of justice and mercy in Christ's actions that is our model as Christians. And for that, we need supernatural divine virtue that comes with grace. Okay. So the cardinal virtues, which typically are prudence, justice, fortitude, and temperance, we can develop natural versions of those virtues. We can develop those, and we should, we need to. But also, with grace, God gives us supernatural prudence, supernatural justice, supernatural fortitude, and supernatural temperance. And the reason these four particular virtues are recommended to us, both on the natural and supernatural level, is because of the important role they play in the moral life. So they're called cardinal, as you can see here from the slide, from the Latin word cardo, which just means hinge, literally like a door hinge. And why are these virtues the hinge of the moral life? Why does the whole moral life turn on these virtues? Well, because when one possesses them, all the other virtues follow. So like it says here, like humility or honesty or chastity, those are kind of like sub-virtues that you only really develop fully when you have these more primary or foundational cardinal virtues of prudence, justice, fortitude, and temperance. So when you go to Father Kelly and you say, Father, I'd really like to grow in holiness and in virtue, he doesn't sort of lean back and then say, okay, all right, let's see here. What he's going to make a recommendation to you. He doesn't say, have you tried taking up knitting? Or maybe tennis? You know, you could really do. Well, knitting is fine, and tennis is good, And developing a habit of either of those things isn't really a bad thing. But your whole moral life isn't going to hinge on whether or not you have the habit of knitting or the habit of tennis, right, or something like that. Because nothing follows from those, right? They're sort of downstream, and they're even further downstream than things like humility and chastity. Rather, if you want to grow morally, you want to develop these first virtues, these virtues from which all the other ones flow. And these are virtues which perfect the powers, right, the abilities or the capacities in us out of which all of our moral actions flow, right? So what are those powers or those capacities in us? Well, it's our intellect, our mind for knowing, our will for choosing and desiring, and our passions, our kind of sensual passions that direct us toward pleasure, and our sort of fight or flight passions which direct us toward things that are difficult, right? If I perfect both of those kinds of passions, and my intellect for knowing the truth about what needs to be done, and my will for choosing and desiring good things and not evil things, then if I have those four virtues, everything else will take care of itself. That's why they're called cardinal. So we can develop these in our everyday life, and by being in a state of grace, we can receive supernatural versions of these from God. So just a brief reflection on each of these. So the virtue that perfects our intellect for knowing the truth about what to be done is prudence. And prudence plays an important role for all the other virtues because it connects them to reason, or even better yet, it connects them to reality. It connects them to reality. So a person could, for example, be quite, you know, kind of brave or fearless naturally, right? But if they don't use that fearlessness that they naturally have for things that are truly good and noble and right and that need to be done, they're not really virtuous. They're just kind of fearless, okay? And it's prudence. It's prudence that connects all of our other powers or capacities to reason, and through reason to reality, to truth. Okay, so prudence is going to dispose our reason to see in every circumstance our true good and what the authentic means to our true good is. And it guides us in making judgments about what needs to be done. And it guides the other virtues in that respect as well. Justice, so prudence perfects our mind to know what needs to be done. Justice perfects our wills to truly desire and choose what needs to be done. Right? And in particular, justice helps us to give in return what is owed to everyone else. So a classic definition of justice is to give to each one his due, what is owed. Right? And we owe many things to many people, some of whom are our peers, friends and family, colleagues. Some, though, who are sort of higher than us, God in particular, to whom we owe all our good. But then also there are some to whom we owe even greater return, like our parents. You know, there are some people in our lives to whom we can never actually give a full return of what we really owe to them. And so there are actually specific virtues that help us, specific virtues that are kind of downstream of justice that help us to do that. To give to God what is owed to him is the virtue of religion, right? And to give to our parents what is owed to them is the virtue of piety, okay? So justice helps perfect our will to desire and choose what is good. And then, because we're not merely angelic creatures with reason and will, but we also have passions, we need to perfect those too. And so fortitude perfects our sort of fight or flight self, you know, our passions that are aroused when we deal with things that are difficult or dangerous, right? And fortitude in particular helps us to avoid weakness or cowardice, right, that we're naturally prone to, fleeing from things that are difficult or harmful when sometimes we need to face them. And then temperance helps us to control our sensual passions, our passions that incline us toward pleasure, right? So temperance, from the very word, like to temper, means to moderate, like to kind of rein it in, to draw back in. And the virtue of temperance sort of tames our passions which are typically overactive with respect to these things, and it helps us to develop moderation in the use and employment of things that are naturally pleasurable, and of passions that tend toward the pleasurable good. All the cardinal virtues need, however, to come together. If you have some of the cardinal virtues but not others, right, you're going to be imbalanced and prone to do what is wrong, okay? Because there's going to be a kind of crack in the edifice, or there's going to be a sort of a weak spot, right? That when you press on it, the whole thing kind of falls apart. So all the cardinal virtues work together. And I think that's where we want to end that one. So do you want to take a 5-minute break?